Hi, we have some exciting news. Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can listen to all of them right now with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the show's page.
This is Crime House.
Chris Watts sat in a small interrogation room hooked up to a polygraph machine and told investigators he had nothing to hide. He said he didn't know where his wife and daughters were. He said he had nothing to do with their disappearance, that he was an innocent man who just wanted his family back. But the results showed a very different story. What followed was one of the most disturbing confessions in modern true crime, and what he described was almost too horrific to believe. Today, I'll take you through the polygraph that cracked Chris Watts and the final confession that revealed what really happened to Shanann, Bella, Cece, and the baby boy they planned to name Nico. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. I want to thank you for being part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of domestic violence, murder, and violence against children. Some of the content in today's episode is especially difficult, so please listen with care. This is our third and final episode on the Watts family murders. Today, I'll cover the polygraph test that broke Chris Watts' composure and the full devastating truth that Chris finally revealed months later from inside a prison cell. On August 15th, 2018, 2 days after his family vanished, 33-year-old Chris Watts was called back to the Frederick, Colorado police station for another round of questioning. By this point, investigators were almost certain that he was responsible. They had the surveillance footage of his truck backing into the garage at 5:27 a.m. on the morning of the disappearance. They had his phone record showing a months-long affair with his coworker, Nicole Kessinger. They had the missing bedsheet. They had a wife who'd left her phone, her purse, her medication, and her wedding ring behind. And they had the testimony of Shanann's mother, Sandra Rusek, who'd called the police directly and told them she believed Chris was involved. But what they didn't have was a confession. So they decided to try something. Under questioning, Chris continued to insist he had nothing to do with his wife and daughter's disappearance. He said he wanted them back. He said he was cooperating fully. He said he had nothing to hide. The detectives nodded, and then they asked him a simple question. If he really was innocent and really had nothing to conceal, would he be willing to take a polygraph test? Chris agreed, so he sat down, let them attach the sensors, and tried to keep his composure. The test was administered by Colorado Bureau of Investigation agent Tammy Lee. Dressed casually in a striped black and white sweater, and her blonde hair cut into a short bob, she looked more like a neighborhood mom than a hard-nosed interrogator. And she spoke to Chris the same way, friendly, warm, like they were having a conversation between old friends. She explained the process of taking a polygraph test in simple, reassuring terms. She told Chris that this was really just a formality, a way to officially clear his name so that the investigation could focus elsewhere. She said she expected the results would rule him out. After all, no one who is actually guilty would be stupid enough to agree to take a polygraph, right? It was a masterful piece of psychological framing. Agent Lee was giving Chris a way to feel safe while setting the trap at the same time. And then she delivered a quiet warning. She said that if the machine showed deception, they'd have to deal with that. but she was confident it wouldn't come to that. Right, Chris? That was when the mask started to slip. Chris shifted in his chair. His breath changed. It was shallow and uneven, like he was holding it in and then releasing it in bursts. His hands were restless. But he couldn't walk away now. Backing out would be worse than failing, so he stayed seated. The questions were direct. Did you cause Shanann's disappearance? Did you lie about the last time you saw her? Do you know where she is now? Agent Lee reminded him to stay calm. Chris tried, but he stumbled over his answers, his voice catching in places it shouldn't have. He complained that it was hard to relax under the circumstances. Lee nodded sympathetically. She was patient, she was kind, but the machine was ruthless. Chris didn't just fail the polygraph, he failed spectacularly. His deception indicators were among the worst Agent Lee had ever recorded. Every question about Shanann's disappearance triggered a response that screamed, "This man is lying." It wasn't looking good for Chris, and what was happening outside that room was about to make it a whole lot worse. While Chris was strapped to the polygraph, investigators had been retracing his movements from the morning of August 13th, the day Shanann and the kids disappeared. Chris's work truck had a GPS tracker installed by his employer, Anadarko Petroleum. Detectives followed the coordinates to the remote oil site where Chris had been assigned that day, a barren stretch of land near Rogan, Colorado, about 35 miles from the Watts home. They sent drones into the sky, scanning the flat, dusty terrain for anything out of place. The land stretched in every direction. Oil tanks, dirt road, scrub brush, and not much else. It didn't look like a place where you'd find evidence of a crime. But then, at around 4:15 p.m., one of the drone operators spotted something. A piece of fabric, flapping in the wind near one of the well sites. When investigators approached from the ground, they realized what it was. A bedsheet, later confirmed to be the missing bedsheet from the Watts' master bedroom. That information was relayed back to the station, and it wasn't the only piece of damning evidence that surfaced while Chris was sitting in that interrogation room. Investigators discovered that on the morning Shanann and the girls disappeared, Chris had called his daughter's school to tell them that Bella and Cece would not be enrolled for the upcoming year. He'd also reached out to a real estate agent about selling the family home. Think about that. His wife and children have been missing for less than a day. He's supposedly worried sick, and he's already pulling the girls out of school and putting the house on the market. For investigators, the picture was becoming impossible to ignore. And back in the interrogation room, Chris was crumbling. After the polygraph, the tone inside the interrogation room changed completely. So far, the detectives had been gentle with Chris, giving him space to tell his version of events. That approach was over. They told Chris he'd failed the polygraph, and not by a little. They told him the results made it crystal clear that he was lying. They pointed out that in the 2 days since his family had disappeared, he hadn't shed a single tear for his missing daughters. They asked him what kind of innocent father doesn't cry when his children are gone. Chris didn't have an answer for that. Under increasing pressure, he admitted to the affair with Nicole Kessinger, who, by the way, I originally thought was a victim, but make sure to stay till the end of the episode for some crazy theories on her. Chris didn't hedge or try to minimize the affair. In fact, he talked about Nicole like a man in a trance. He told investigators that she took his breath away. He said he'd never felt like this about anyone before. Chris described his and Nicole's relationship with a warmth and openness that was completely absent when he talked about his wife and children. But when it came to what happened to Shanann, Bella, and Cece, Chris stammered. He deflected. He said he didn't know anything more than what he'd already told them. He was holding onto his story like a man clinging to the edge of a cliff. The detectives kept pressing, and then Agent Tammy Lee offered him something, a lifeline, a way out. She asked Chris if maybe Shanann had done something to the girls. Maybe Shanann had hurt them, and Chris had reacted by doing something to her. It was a scenario that would allow Chris to confess to killing his wife while shifting the blame for his daughter's deaths onto the victim herself. It was a classic interrogation technique. Give the suspect a version of events that's less damning than the full truth. Let them grab onto it. And once they start talking, you keep pulling the thread until everything unravels. And Chris took the bait. Chris's father, Ronnie Watts, had been waiting at the station. When investigators told him his son wanted to talk, Ronnie agreed to go into the interrogation room. The officers and agents left the two men alone, but the room was wired. Both audio and video were being recorded. Chris sat across from his father with his shoulder slumped and his voice barely above a whisper. That the detectives weren't going to let him leave, that things were bad. His dad listened, and then he gently asked if there was a reason the detectives shouldn't let him go. Chris paused, and then almost in a whisper, he said he was done protecting Shanann. What came next was a story that sent a chill through everyone listening, especially those who didn't see the interrogators feed him this story. Chris told his dad that on the morning of August 13th, he'd woken up and told Shanann he wanted a divorce. That sparked an argument and Shanann stormed out. And then Chris said he looked at the baby monitor and saw something that stopped his heart. Shanann was smothering Cece. And when he ran to the bedroom, their other daughter, Bella, was already lifeless in her bed. Chris said he snapped. He said something inside of him broke. And in a fit of rage over what Shanann had done to their babies, he strangled her. Ronnie was devastated. Nothing in the world could have prepared him to hear a confession like that from his own son. All he could think to do was reach across the table and take Chris's hand. When the detectives returned to the room, Chris repeated the same story. He admitted to strangling Shanann, but he insisted that she'd killed the girls first. He said he'd seen it on the baby monitor. He painted himself as a man who'd been pushed past his breaking point to unimaginable trauma. Investigators listened to every word, and they didn't believe any of it. Not only had they just fed him this narrative to get him to confess without taking the entire blame, they'd already spoken to Shanann's friends and family. They knew the kind of mother she was. She put those girls before everything else in her life. She would have thrown herself in front of a train for them. Nothing, absolutely nothing, about what Chris was describing matched the woman everyone knew. But even with his story full of holes, Chris gave them something they desperately needed. When they asked where the bodies were, he initially avoided the question. He seemed unable or unwilling to say it out loud, so the investigators left him alone with his dad again. And it was Ronnie who coaxed it out of him. Sitting in that room, father to son, Ronnie got Chris to admit the truth. He'd buried Shanann in a shallow grave near the oil site, and he had forced the bodies of his daughters, 4-year-old Bella and 3-year-old Cece, into crude oil tanks at the same location. Ronnie was heartbroken. Chris was his son. Those girls were his granddaughters. Outside of the interrogation room, watching the camera feed in real time, detectives were stunned. They'd suspected Chris from nearly the beginning, but hearing him describe what he had done with his own children's bodies was something else entirely. Investigators walked back into the room and slid an aerial photograph of Chris's worksite across the table. They asked him to point out exactly where he'd left them. Chris hesitated. Then he pointed to 2 areas on the map, one where he had buried Shanann and another where he'd hidden the girls. Around 11 p.m. on August 15th, 2018, 3 days after his family disappeared, 33-year-old Chris Watts was formally arrested and charged with the murders of his pregnant wife, Shanann, their unborn son, and their 2 daughters, Bella and Cece. Despite his attempt to shift the blame, investigators had 0 reason to believe his version of events. Chris had the motive. He wanted a fresh start with his girlfriend. He had the means. He was strong enough to overpower them. And he had the opportunity. He'd been alone with his family in the early morning hours. Overnight and into the morning of August 16th, 2018, the Colorado authorities carried out the grim task of recovering Chris's family. And a trigger warning here, because what I'm about to describe is hard to process. Shanann's body was found in a shallow grave near the oil site, partially wrapped in a missing bedsheet from their home. She was still wearing the clothes she had had on when she walked through the front door in the early hours of August 13th. Bella and Cece were discovered inside the crude oil tanks Chris had indicated. He'd forced their small bodies through a hatch opening that was just 8 inches wide. At the mouth of one of the tanks, investigators found a tuft of blonde hair that had gotten caught as the tiny body was pushed through. I want to pause on that detail for a moment, because it's easy to get numb to the facts of a case like this when you're processing them as a narrative. But this is the part where we need to stop and remember that we are talking about children, a four-year-old and a three-year-old, girls who had favorite blankets, bedtime routines, and silly songs they sang. And their father stuffed their bodies into oil tanks in a field in the middle of nowhere and drove to work. News of Chris's arrest spread across Colorado and then across the country within hours. The horror of what had happened and the way it had happened reverberated through the community in Frederick and far beyond it. Neighbors who'd waved to Chris in the driveway, coworkers who'd eaten lunch with him, friends who'd watched Shanann's Facebook Live videos and thought they seemed like such a happy family. Everyone was asking the same question. How did we not see it? The following week, prosecutors announced the formal charges. Chris faced 9 criminal counts, 5 counts of first-degree murder, 2 for each daughter because they were under the age of 12 under Colorado law, plus 1 count for Shanann. He was also charged with the unlawful termination of Shanann's pregnancy and 3 counts of tampering with a deceased human body. And then, in the aftermath of the arrests and the charges in the national news coverage, something cruel and deeply disturbing began to happen. The internet turned on Shanann. One of the reasons was because of Chris's version of events, and I think this one is really on the investigators. I understand they wanted a confession and knew that feeding Chris a story that would put less blame on him would work, but it also created a narrative that wouldn't have existed otherwise. I don't think Chris would have said Shanann killed the kids if that wasn't something that was suggested to him. And although they obviously didn't believe the story and charged Chris with the girls' murders, I don't think they did enough to dispel that narrative because some people truly believed she might have killed the girls. I think that was an injustice to Shanann and her family. But there were also some people who didn't believe Chris's narrative that still came after her. Because of her extensive social media presence, the hundreds of Facebook posts, videos, and live streams documenting her life, there was a massive public archive of who Shanann was and how she lived. And this vocal corner of the internet decided to use that archive against her. They judged her personality, they nitpicked her parenting, they called her controlling, manipulative, and a narcissist. Strangers who'd never met Shanann Watts felt entitled to dissect her character, and in some cases, to blame her for her own murder. They claimed she drove him to it, as if something about who she was as a person could explain or justify what her husband did to her and their children. The cruelty didn't stop with Shanann. It spread to her grieving family. Her parents, Sandra and Frank Rusek, and her brother Frankie were forced to endure endless online speculation, name-calling, and conspiracy theories at the very same time they were mourning the loss of their loved ones. I want to be very clear about something. There is no version of the story in which Shanann bears any responsibility for what happened to her. She was a wife, a mother, and a human being who was murdered by the person who was supposed to protect her. And the fact that she had a big personality or that she posted a lot on social media or that she was opinionated about her kids' allergies, none of that is relevant. Victim blaming in any form is inexcusable. And in this case, it reached a level of viciousness that was genuinely shocking. The harassment continued for months until finally Chris agreed to a plea deal and the full story came to light. On November 6th, 2018, Chris Watts pled guilty to all 9 counts against him. He admitted to murdering Shanann, Bella, and Cece. But even in his guilty plea, he still hadn't publicly confessed to killing his daughters. The plea deal was structured so that he simply accepted guilt on every charge, without requiring him to give a narrative of what happened. He was going to be punished for it all the same, though, but he wasn't getting the death penalty, in large part thanks to Shanann's family. Despite everything that had been done to them, the Ruseks made it clear they didn't want another death resulting from this tragedy. That takes a kind of grace I'm not sure most of us could find in the same situation. In court, Chris sat silent as the judge read the charges. Prosecutors didn't require him to speak. They didn't want him using the courtroom to spin the same false story about Shanann killing the girls. They wanted the record to be clear. Shanann was a victim, not a perpetrator. 2 weeks later, the judge handed down the sentence. Chris received 3 consecutive life sentences, 1 for each murder, plus 2 additional life sentences to be served concurrently for the deaths of Bella and Cece under the child victim statute. The judge added 48 years for the unlawful termination of Shanann's pregnancy and 36 years for tampering with the bodies, all without the possibility of parole. Chris Watts would never see the outside of a prison again. By the standards of most high-profile murder cases, the resolution was remarkably fast. Within 3 months of the crime, the case had gone from disappearance to arrest to guilty plea to sentencing. But the story wasn't finished, because investigators still didn't have the full truth about what happened inside that house on August 13th. But in February of 2019, Chris finally gave it to them. Investigators visited Chris in prison for a follow-up interview. They wanted his complete confession, the one where he'd refused to give 5 months earlier. The interview lasted 5 hours, and slowly, piece by piece, the truth came out. Chris said Shanann had come home from her business trip around 2 a.m. He suspected she might know about the affair since he hadn't exactly been careful. He used their joint credit card to take Nicole out to dinner while Shanann was in Arizona. But when Shanann walked through the door, she didn't mention it. She was still fighting for the marriage that Chris had already decided to leave. A few hours later, around 5 a.m., Chris woke up and told her he wanted a divorce. Shanann was blindsided. She asked if there was someone else. It turned out she still wasn't sure he was cheating. She'd suspected it, but she didn't have proof. Chris had expected her to already know. He thought the affair would make the conversation easier, that she'd agree to separate without a fight. But Shanann didn't make it easy. She was devastated and angry, and she told Chris that if he left her, he would never see his daughters again. Again, trigger warning here for violent content, because that was when Chris put his hands around her neck. He strangled Shanann until she and their unborn son were dead. And then came the part of the confession that investigators, and later the world, found almost unbearable. 4-year-old Bella walked into the room. She was clutching her pink blanket the way little kids do when they've been startled awake. She saw her mother lying still on the bed, and she asked, "What's wrong with mommy?" Chris told her everything would be okay, but it wouldn't be. He carried Shanann's body to the garage and loaded her into the backseat of his work truck. Then he told Bella and Cece to climb in too. The girls obeyed. Their mother's body lay at their feet as Chris drove them more than 45 minutes through the dark to the oil field where he worked. Along the way, the girls kept asking if their mom was okay. Chris told them she was fine and that she was just sleeping. When they arrived, Chris killed his daughters. He smothered Cece first, then Bella. And according to Chris, Bella's final moments were the worst part of it all. As he pressed his hands over her face, she looked at him and said, "Daddy, no." Those were her last words. Afterward, Chris buried Shanann in the shallow grave. Then he forced Bella and Cece's bodies into the oil tanks. Chris's full confession was made public in March of 2019. It finally confirmed what investigators had believed all along. Shanann had never harmed her children. She'd been a devoted mother, a woman who loved her daughters fiercely and unconditionally, and who was trying right up until the end to hold her family together, until her husband chose to destroy it. Shanann Watts, Bella Watts, Celeste, Cece Watts, and the baby boy they planned to name Nico. 4 lives ended by the one person in the world who should have protected them. Their story shouldn't be defined by the brutality of how it ended. Shanann lived with energy, determination, and a fierce commitment to giving her children the best life she could. Bella was gentle and kind, a little girl who loved her pink blanket and worried about her mommy even in the worst moment of her life. Cece was bold and spirited, the kid who lit up every room she walked into. And Nico was already deeply loved, already named, already part of the family, even before he had the chance to take a single breath. This case horrified America for a lot of reasons. The cruelty of the crime, the banality of the man who committed it, the fact that it happened in the house that looked like every other house on the block. But I think the thing that lingers most, the thing people can't shake, is the image of a 4-year-old girl walking into her parents' bedroom, clutching a pink blanket, and asking what was wrong with her mommy. Because that moment captures everything about this case, the innocence that was destroyed, the trust that was weaponized, and the fact that Chris Watts looked his daughter in the eye, told her everything would be okay, and then killed her anyway. There is no version of that story that makes sense. There is no psychological profile that fully explains it. There is just the fact that it happened and the obligation we have to remember the people it happened to. Shanann, Bella, Cece, and Nico deserved better. They deserved so much better. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts, so make sure to comment below.
Agent Tammy Lee's interrogation strategy, building trust, acting sympathetic, offering Chris an out by suggesting Shanann killed the girls, is that a common technique, and how do you feel about it ethically?
It's extremely common, and it's actually one of the most effective tools investigators have, but the way they went about it in this case, quite frankly, pissed me off. The approach Agent Lee used is sometimes called the Reed technique, and the basic idea is that you build rapport with the suspect, make them feel comfortable, and then offer them a less damning version of events that they can latch onto. The theory is that most guilty people want to confess on some level. They just need a way to do it that lets them save face or minimize their responsibility. In Chris's case, it worked perfectly, but I believe it was at the expense of the real victim. The out Lee gave him was that maybe Shanann did something to the girls and you reacted, which Chris grabbed onto immediately. He was so desperate to not be seen as a man who killed his own children that he was willing to throw his dead wife under the bus to shift the blame. But because the means of how this confession transpired wasn't revealed to the public, many people believe that Shanann was the one who killed her daughters. It sullied the name of this loving mother who would never harm her children. And some people still question it. Chris's mom, to this day, is still running with this theory. So ethically, I absolutely have concerns about this technique, especially because it has led to false confessions from actually innocent people in some cases. One thing that was shocking to me is how terrible of a liar Chris was. You think someone who is capable of killing their entire family would be a better liar, but he stumbled at every single turn. I truly don't think Chris would have come up with this narrative if it wasn't spoon-fed to him minutes before he confessed to his dad. I mean, he wasn't even convincing telling his dad this new story. So yes, it was effective. Yes, they got a confession. Yes, they were able to find the bodies. But I'm still mad that so many people believe Shanann was capable of doing that to her own kids. People were so desperate to make her out to be the villain. I can't imagine how heartbreaking that was for her family as well. I also don't think that was the only mistake investigators made in this case.
What do you think the other mistake is that investigators made?
Well, this one's interesting. I think another big mistake was not taking a harder look at Nicole. When I first started researching this case, I thought she was almost another victim of Chris. She came forward pretty early, saying that he had lied to her, that she didn't know he was still married, that she didn't even know Shanann's name, that she definitely didn't know she was pregnant. And she even went so far as to say she tried to encourage Chris to try and work things out with his wife. But the more I dug into this case and looked at the evidence, there were a lot of holes in Nicole's statement. The first thing I find extremely odd was that data analysts recovered 3 deleted online searches for Chris and Shanann on Nicole Kessinger's phone almost a year before she worked at Anadarko or claimed to have met Chris. On August 3rd, 2017, she searched for Chris Watts. On September 1st, 2017, she searched for Shanann Watts. And she searched again on January 17th, 2018 for Shanann Watts and spelled it correctly both times, which is an odd spelling of a name. But Nicole claimed that her and Chris didn't even meet until May or June 2018. So she obviously lied about when they met. She obviously lied about not knowing Chris's significant other's name for a while because she consistently viewed Shanann's Facebook page where it was very clear that they were still together and where Shanann had announced she was pregnant. So I don't buy for a second that she didn't know she was pregnant. Regarding her claiming she was trying to encourage Chris to work things out with his wife on his trip to North Carolina, She was searching for wedding dresses when he was gone, talking to him every day, even multiple times a day, and even has deleted searches for things along the lines of marrying your mistress and man I'm having affair with says he will leave his wife. Then we have her deleting calls, text messages, and Google searches off of her phone, as well as Google searches trying to find out if cops can read deleted text messages. Then she tried to destroy her SIM card before handing her phone off to the police. She also has no alibi for the morning of the murders. Her phone pinged in Frederick, where Chris lived, around 6 a.m. Her house is 25 minutes away, and the night before when they were FaceTiming, her phone pinged by her house. So it wasn't just a mistake that it could have pinged in Frederick when she was at her house. The morning of the murders, a neighbor saw a truck similar to the one Nicole owned outside of the Watts home. There's also a person caught on the neighbor's surveillance video who many think looks like Nicole, but is very blurry, so that is very speculative. Nicole didn't show up at work until 3 p.m. the day after. As a safety officer, Nicole was also very familiar with the site where the bodies were buried, including the fact that there could have easily been an explosion that would destroy the bodies and the evidence. Phone records show that Nicole and Chris were in close contact the night before, morning of, and day following the murders. I also originally thought Nicole came forward on her own, which she kind of did, but on August 15th, almost 2 hours before Nicole contacted the police for the first time, a manager at Endarco called the police and told them about emails they had discovered that confirmed their affair. It is believed that Nicole was tipped off about this call, and then that's why she called the police. In discovery, there was also a statement from one of the officers who was trying to call Chris at 2 a.m., and he said they played phone tag for about 10 minutes, and every time there was dead air on the line. After 10 minutes, Chris hung up, called Nicole for 1 minute, hung up, called the officer back on his work phone, and at the same time, Nicole called Chris's personal phone, and both calls lasted for 11 minutes. That was the last call between Nicole and Chris, and people believe that he had put the officer on speaker so Nicole could hear what information the officers had. The last thing that's not necessarily evidence, but that really creeped me out, were some of the voicemails she left Chris when he was out of town, laughing and talking in sort of a baby voice. I have to play them for you because it gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Hi. It's me. You guys just call me back when you have a chance. Bye.
Personally, I think Nicole knew a lot more than she let on, and I wish the cops looked more deeply into her. But what do you think? Be sure to leave a comment below. I want to hear all of your thoughts. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. Make sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crime so we can keep building this community together. And to get all episodes at once, ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Come back next week for another deep dive into a true crime that changed America.